I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. So imagine this. Imagine having a brain that just won't stop. You sit down to read an assignment, and you look at it and look at it, and after you've read it three or four times, nothing has gone into your head. And that's just one event in the day. Multiply that by every single task you do. Setting the table, something else grabs your attention. Getting out the door, you're going to be late because so many things have grabbed your attention. It's exhausting, and it's all part of what we're labeling attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So is it really a brain disorder, or is it something in our environment? Let's talk about that. My guests today are Dr. Marilyn Wedge. She's written A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. And by the way, the book compares his diagnosis and drug treatment with other countries. And there's some interesting results she found. Marilyn, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure to be here.
And later on, we're going to hear from Dr. Russell Ramsey. He's here at Penn, an associate professor of clinical psychology. And he's going to speak about traditional and non-traditional treatments being used today. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Please, please call early in the show. I have a feeling our lines are going to be backed up pretty quickly. After all, Marilyn, this does touch the lives of a lot of people.
Yeah, it certainly does.
Speaking of numbers of people, you noted in your book that the incidence of ADHD in children climbed from the low single digits 20 years ago to 14% today. And frankly, Marilyn, I would challenge that number of 14%. I think it's much higher. So what's your understanding of what ADHD really is, and then why is it increasing?
Well, my view of ADHD is that the problems of childhood have always been around. And as you noticed, there's a higher percentage now because I think parenting has become more challenging with all the stress on families. The way I like to put it is that if parenting a calm child or a girl is like driving a car, driving an active, energetic boy, whom we might label ADHD, is more like driving a Mack truck. You have to think about what you're doing all the time. And not only are children who are very active challenging to parent, they're also challenging to teach. So I think that as classrooms become more crowded, as life has become more complicated, more children are being diagnosed through a medical lens of having a disorder. And the reason for that is that there exists a medicine, a pill, that will help calm them down. So in some ways, as I say in my book, I think the medicine has not just created but perpetuated and expanded the diagnosis.
So you actually think the medication actually helped create this diagnosis?
I do. And that's happened before with the history of psychiatry. In the 90s, the new antidepressants came out, Prozac, and they helped many people. But the fact is that depression started spreading, and now almost every human sadness or grief is labeled as depression, and an antidepressant is prescribed.
Well, I think, but we know depression is a very real phenomenon. You know, it's not, it's certainly not created by drug companies.
Well, that's true. And so perhaps that was not the correct analogy.
Yeah, I also want to challenge something else you said.
Mm-hmm.
About another explanation for why it's skyrocketing. Look at the incidence of autism over the years, and that's terrifying when you look at those numbers. And many argue that that's simply because it's better diagnosed now. I mean, there's no great pharmaceutical answer for autism. So is it possible that, you know, ADHD is being better diagnosed?
Well, first I would argue that there's no pharmaceutical answer for autism. Most autistic children are drugged with various psychiatric medications. What was your question after autism?
Well, you know, is it just being diagnosed better?
Diagnosed more.
Yeah, and is it being diagnosed better? Are we more sensitive to it than before? I mean, I don't want to be too black and white here, Marilyn, you know?
Sure, Dan. I think that many doctors would say that that is the case, that there are more sensitive instruments for diagnosis, but those instruments have expanded.
Yeah.
Since 1980, a child has to have fewer symptoms to be diagnosed, and it can be at a later age. Instead of being diagnosed by the age of 4, the child could be diagnosed by the age of 7, and then the age of 12, and then any age.
So let's unpack this business of diagnosis, and I want to follow up on an article you wrote in 2012. And the title, the provocative title, is Why French Kids Don't Have ADHD. And technically they do, but it's around 1% or maybe even a drop lower. So in that article, you raise a question about whether ADHD is a biological, neurological disorder. And compare how children are diagnosed in the United States versus France.
Well, in the United States, it's a very quick process. There's a checklist of symptoms of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. And the doctor with the child's parents can go through the checklist in 15 minutes. So after 15 minutes, a diagnosis can be made. Of course, you know, the parent has told the doctor the child's history at school and they're having problems. Maybe the school has referred the child. But it's a 15 to 20 minute process. And then the child walks out of the office with a diagnosis of ADHD and a prescription for stimulant medication. In France, the process takes much more time, and it's taken a lot more seriously. It's something like 8 sessions of consultation with the child, with the child's family. And what is looked at is not for a possible disorder in the child's brain, but a disorder in the child's social environment. What is troubling the child? Is there a family situation that is troubling the child? Is the child not in the right classroom at school? Is he maybe too young in his maturity level for the class that he's in? So the social environmental factors are taken very seriously in France and in other countries in Europe. Whereas today in the United States, the biological brain model is the lens through which we see most of human behavior.
Well, yeah, and I mean, we've been trying to, you know, see everything in the brain since the 90s. It was declared the decade of the brain back then. I just, you know, when I first heard about ADD, I mean, I was a young psychologist, and what we were taught about the assessment is very similar to what they did in France. We had to, you know, talk to teachers, talk to parents, mm-hmm. ideally go into the home, you mm-hmm. know, and it's very similar to what they did in France. But, you know, you talk about Europe, and I'm not disagreeing with you here, Marilyn, but, you know, Europe, they have this social safety net. They have, you know, health care that really covers all people and, you know, a lot of issues. Who's going to pay for a thorough assessment in this country? You know, it's heartbreaking.
Well, that really is, because it's much less expensive for the payer or the insurance company to pay for a 15-minute session than for 8 sessions of evaluation, and then the doctor might refer the kid to family therapy, and so you have to pay for some sessions of family therapy. So I agree that there isn't – here it's kind of looking for the least expensive quick fix.
Let me just take a minute, Marilyn, and reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Wedge about her position, her book, A Disease Called Childhood, and she argues that we are diagnosing and medicating what can be considered a typical childhood behavior, and B, we're medicating kids who don't need to be medicated. I do have to say there was one thing that I read in my research about your background that I was uncomfortable with. And in your articles and books, you come back to the question of nutrition and food additives as a possible cause of ADHD. Did I read that right?
It's a possible cause in some children. In the studies, it's about 40-45% of children. And it's not all children. It's like an allergy. I have an allergy to strawberries, but you might not, and a lot of other people don't. But if I get strawberries, I become very ill. So it's the same thing. Some children have an extreme reaction of hyperactivity to food dyes, artificial food colorings, and preservatives. But it's not, so it's cure for ADHD to remove these, but it's some children benefit from a change in diet.
You said 45%?
This was in the research that came out of the work of Dr. Benjamin Feingold. Mm-hmm. He was a pediatric allergist in the 1970s, and he found that between 40-50% of children who were hyperactive, when you remove the food dyes and preservatives, artificial preservatives, from their diet, the hyperactivity ceased, and it ceased very dramatically. So the Feingold study was replicated in Europe, in Great Britain, in the Southampton study.
Was this a controlled study?
It was a controlled, placebo-controlled crossover study. Feingold didn't do that, and he was criticized. Feingold just did cases. Well, but the Southampton study was a careful, placebo-controlled study.
Let's see if we can get a phone call on before we have to take our break. Let's go to Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What can we do for you?
Sure. I wanted to share my concerns. I've worked for many, many years in early childhood education, particularly special education, with preschoolers through elementary school. And while I understand your concern about overdiagnosing children and medicating children that don't need it, I feel that you're really making sweeping generalizations in the conversation, and that you're potentially hurting a really vulnerable population that needs our understanding and our support.
Yeah, and I want to address that. So, Marilyn, how would you answer Stephanie?
Well, I don't agree that, one thing I do agree with you, Stephanie, is that people who truly need to be to have help, to have counseling and supportive therapy, they should have it. But I don't think children need to be medicated. I think there are many more ways of helping children with individual therapy, family therapy, dietary interventions, looking at the kind of discipline they receive in the household. Are their parents keeping a calm and nurturing environment at home? So I really don't think medication is necessary for children, even for the most hyperactive. I think it can be addressed. These medications have long-term effects. We're finding out now that they are addictive, that kids tend to rely on them in high school and college and even afterwards. So I do think it's time to look for other alternatives apart from psychiatric medication.
Well, I look, you know, Marilyn and Stephanie, I'm in a very special position here, that the people I speak to professionally about ADD and ADHD are researchers and who are up on the data and using the data to treat these kids. And those I speak with say that medication for children is really a last resort, but none of them want to take it off the table ever. You know,
may I add one more thought?
Yeah.
I think because I've been in this field for, I would say, about 30 years, I think this idea that we're diagnosing children because there's medication available, it's really the flip. I think that we've had children out there in the communities who have had needs and have had concerns and have needed support. And the more that we've learned about what children struggle with and understood and been able to name these things that they struggle with, whether it's autism or attention deficit or any of these things, it's not that we're creating the problems in the children. We're really identifying what their needs are. And I can tell you that families, educators, medical professionals, we don't want to medicate the children that we either parent or are serving the community. But we want that as an option when we've tried all of the other things in conjunction with that.
Well,
educational environment, the home environment, the community, and then also addressing it if there is a need medically.
Stephanie and Marilyn, I would just say, and then we're going to have to take a short break. I would just say, please, it's not either or. It's both and. You know, medication is important, and you know, medication, some of these promos for this medication is just infuriating, you know, and I agree 100% with what Marilyn's saying, certainly around the antidepressants, that we're medicating sadness, that we've got no tolerance now or little tolerance for our own emotions because of pharmaceutical marketing. So I'm deeply troubled by that, but that doesn't mean drugs don't work, and that doesn't mean drugs aren't indicated for a lot of what's going on, but it's got to be a last resort. Any competent physician or therapist, it should be a last resort. That said, Marilyn, we're going to take our short break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Russell Ramsey, an associate professor of clinical psychology here in the neighborhood. He's at Penn. He's co-written Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Adult ADHD and the Adult ADHD Toolkit, and I'm really curious to hear what he has to say about kids and his reaction to our conversation. So stay tuned. We'll be back after a 60-second break. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Caring Friends Home Care, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides in-home care. Services include home care aides, meal preparation, dressing, hygiene, light housekeeping, and more. With hourly or live-in care, clients receive services while remaining in their own homes. Clients living in long-term care communities can receive additional support. Details at caringfriendshomecare.org.
Thanks to you, our mini campaign was a success. I'm Mike and Scott, and we made over $100,000 in one day. This also means we'll receive the challenge donation of over $26,000 from a group of anonymous donors. Your support helps WHYY stay on track to provide the news and programming you expect from us. If you haven't pledged yet, now is the time. Visit WHYY.org or call 1-888-345-9499. And thank you.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about this phenomenon called ADHD in children. What is it really? And what are the best approaches to it? We've been talking with Dr. Marilyn Wedge, who argues that many times we're medicating normal childhood. We're now joined by Russell Ramsey, an associate professor of clinical psychology at University of Pennsylvania, who specializes in ADHD treatment and research. Russ, welcome to the show.
Dan, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
So you listened to our first segment.
Yes.
Of the show. So you've said that in your book that there have been hundreds of published papers over the last 45 years that have documented that stimulant medication are effective for children and adolescents with ADHD. They might be, but Marilyn argues, we'd have to take a look at this. Marilyn argues that there's other ways of being effective that are safer for our children.
And I'll add into that, and adults with ADHD. And to borrow a phrase that you used before, I'll adopt a both-and approach. But like one of the central pieces I just want to address quickly, there's the question, the entry point of making the diagnosis, doing the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we know, there was a review several years ago about adults with ADHD and the presumed overdiagnosis. And when there was a review of studies and how the assessments were done, the recipe for overdiagnosis is only using screening scales and a single source of information with which to make the diagnosis, so maybe one reporter. So when you use a multi-method approach, trying to reach, touch base with several people, be it a teacher and a parent or with adults, a significant other, along with the existing gold standard diagnostic evaluation, the reliability, the accuracy goes way up. And one other thing is the question of who is making the diagnosis.
Yeah.
I think right now the diagnosis is often being made, and I say this with all respect because they're overworked and they're asked to do a whole lot more than maybe they're prepared to do in a brief visit, but primary care physicians.
Right.
When we get specialists doing this, again, we get a fuller evaluation looking at the whole context, and the diagnostic accuracy goes up.
Yeah, I'm not even sure about your last statement about specialists, because, your average run-of-the-mill psychiatrist or psychologist doesn't have the training in doing these complex assessments.
And that's when maybe I use specialists. I'm used to, our program at Penn, where we have an adult ADHD program, and our friends and colleagues down the street at CHOP, who have a wonderful program. That's what I'm talking about with the gold standard in terms of the evaluation.
No, you're just showing off for us.
Dan, I mentioned my friends
down
the street.
Can I say something about the published research?
Please.
I've done a great deal of looking into the research that says that medication helps children, and I'm talking about children.
Right.
And I have not found one study in which the researcher, in which at least one researcher has been paid by drug companies. Or in other cases, the research study was in part funded by a drug company. And I've taken very seriously the meta-analyses of these papers by Dr. Francois Guanon at the University of Bordeaux, and he shows that these studies are internally inconsistent, that the conclusions don't follow from the data, and that the even those published in top medical journals, like the Journal of the American Medical Association or the Lancet, also 11% of the papers published in these journals are ghostwritten by pharmaceutical companies.
I find I'm woo, that
don't believe me. Take a look yourself.
Well,
Robert. Go ahead.
I mean, I don't want to get too wonky here with research, lest I get confused and fall asleep because of my ADHD. the FDA can't. The FDA can't approve a drug if all the research has been subsidized by pharmaceutical.
They don't get the negative results. They get the negative results, but they're not published. The only result, the FDA has to get all the results, but the ones that get a lot of attention are the positive results. And actually, it's come out lately that some of the negative results don't even get reported to the FDA.
Are you aware of this, Russ?
Well, there is a publication bias just in general peer review journals. In fact, I think there was a journal that came out years ago about that would specialize in publishing the negative findings. So we're talking about the intersection of the science and industry, which is a concern. That said, all researchers who do get, you know, funding, this has to be disclosed so these things, you know, so light can be shed on them, so they can be reviewed through the lens of that. But that said, there are many strong studies with that have had federal funding. And again, even if the researchers' funding comes from the NIH, NIMH, they still have to cite any potential conflict, so these can be reviewed. However, the wealth of studies would still support, and this is true across the age range, that if you had to rely on one treatment for treating the symptoms of ADHD, the and I'm a psychologist, the stimulant medications have the strongest effect sizes. Now, that said, as a psychologist, does that mean it necessarily translates into functional and behavioral improvements?
Let's
to a degree, but there might be more steps taken to improve overall well-being.
All right. I want to talk about kids here.
Yeah.
Real people. And I'll start with me and you know, I had it before I was diagnosed, and I failed at school. You know, I failed as early as fifth grade, sixth grade, and I failed throughout. I flunked out of my first college, and this phenomenon, this failure, informed my life and my ideas about myself in very profound ways over the next four decades. So I want to be careful about ways of taking care of these kids. And I'll just add one other thing. The semester I made the dean's list in college was the semester I was taking illegal amphetamines. And then I made the dean's list. Then I actually realized I enjoyed studying. I enjoyed learning. So we have to take care of these kids. And, I mean, talk about damage. And my story, how many millions of times could you multiply that one story? Marilyn, Russ, I want to hear your reaction.
I wonder, Dan, if you had received help in terms of individual or family counseling early on. Might that have helped you or not?
Of course, hindsight. I really have no idea. My family was loving and supportive. I guess I could have used somebody sitting next to me while I was doing my homework. But, you know, I was from the early ones who had two working parents. Who was there? You know, this is the truth of my life and so many other kids' lives. So, and one of the things I wonder, and I'll turn to you, Russ, my brain, these kids' brains, you know, is there a hunger for what the brain hunger for whatever hormone gets released from these stimulants?
The short answer, I would say, in part, is yes, that can be one component of what's helpful. But there's also the felt experience of whatever the challenge might be. That could be being able to complete your math homework. It could be remembering to take the recycling out. And these sorts of behavioral changes, and sometimes it is intervening with the family, helping the parents, and these are often loving, concerned parents, who need to adapt their parenting for the unique interaction of this child with the surrounding environment, be that school, be it peer relationships. And that's one of the more insidious outcomes we're finding from growing up with ADHD, is the impact it has on relationships with parents, peers, and whatnot. So just helping children understand, and then adolescents and as adults, we see it morph differently throughout the age range, just being able to figure out what they need to be doing, and most importantly, to be able to implement that on their own with help and whatnot.
Let's get a phone call in. We've got Vicki on the line. Vicki, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
This is an amazing show. I have 5 children, 3 of whom have either what you'd call ADD or ADHD. The first one, one is a girl and 2 are boys. The girl is the oldest. She wasn't diagnosed until middle school. I think girls present a bit differently, and we had no clue what was going on with her. It took a psychiatrist a fair amount of time to, you know, dig into it. And when he came up with that, I was astonished at the difference. And then the second one is a boy, and he sort of has the same thing. The third one has the Ever-Ready Battery Bunny syndrome, where he keeps going and going. He definitely has the H. But the other two, the first two don't. And I did not, you know, I didn't go to the doctor saying, I want medication.
And you suggested when you spoke to Zakiya Gibbons, our intern who answers the phone, you said that the ADHD meds make a difference, and that you feel this has little to do with the structure in your home. Tell us about it.
We have good structure in our home. I've taken lots of parenting classes. We have, you know, firm limits and consequences, and we hold down on them and everything. And the medication makes all the difference. And now that the children are older, the youngest now is 13, they will report to me, Mom, I can't focus. Mom, I can't read this book. I can't get this homework done. They know that it makes a difference for them.
You know, the good news and bad news about there's so much of it being so public. You know, thank goodness your son knows he has a problem with focusing. I mean, that's the good news about it being so visible, or else he would just think there was something wrong with him. I want to hear, and thanks so much for your call.
There was one other thing that I have. There's an oppositional behavior component that goes along with ADHD, and I never understood that until we got into this whole thing, that also the medication is very helpful with. Otherwise, my children will not do anything I ask them unless I say, you can do this or you can lose that.
Well, thanks so much. And I want to hear both of our experts take just briefly react to what you heard from Vicki. Start with you, Marilyn.
Well, you know, I was recalling what you said, Dan, that it might have helped you to have a parent sit down with you when you were doing your homework. That's one of the prescriptions I give parents who bring in children like this. And so I was just wondering if Vicki, if her son is complaining, I can't focus on my homework, if she or her husband, another caregiver, was sat down with them at the kitchen table and help them, they could read together and talk about the meaning of what they had just read. So, you know, I think that's a great help. The second thing is that there's no doubt that medication stimulants help, but are they helping as a performance enhancer, or are they helping as medicine?
Well, what I learned way back when, and you know, I think I learned it from Tony Rastain, who you work with over at Penn, Russ, that if you really have ADHD, then it works as a medication. That if you don't and you're just using it, that it's not, you're more likely to abuse it, and it is a performance enhancer. Am I remembering that right? Are we still thinking that way, Russ?
No, I'd say that's a fair characterization. One of the ways we think about ADHD now, and this is across the lifespan, the A and the H are red herrings in a way. They're important symptoms, but it's really a problem of self-regulation.
Huh.
How well can you do what you set out to do? Because most of what we want to do, like a child in a 7-year-old in first grade doesn't want to get in trouble for shouting out the answer without raising his hand. And you ask him, what are the rules? He will be able to cite it. I'm supposed to raise my hand, wait to be called on. So ADHD, in some ways, it's not a knowledge deficit. You don't want to keep telling him to raise your hand, raise your hand. It is a performance deficit. So it's not a performance enhancer like we think, like performance-enhancing drugs in the Tour de France or other sports. But it does help with the self-regulation and managing the various contexts, relationships, and situations, just like the caller just described. It helped what was good structure provided in the household and doing probably all the correct behavioral things. As Marilyn said, that would be hopefully the standard recommendations. They also help them, the children, follow them and make good use of the environment that they were providing.
I've got to tell you, you just touched on something that is enormous and we're hearing more and more about, and that's self-regulation. I mean, we hear it with ADHD. We hear it with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
We hear it with anxiety disorders and depression. So, and it all plays in to this business of self-regulation. And my God, we know better ways of regulating than just drugs. So that's where we're going to end it for now. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about what really does work. What do we know that really does work? We're talking with Marilyn Wedge, who's written a disease called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. Dr. J. Russell Ramsey over at Penn has co-written Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Adult ADHD. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY FM.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering a campus tour on April 29th at 9 a.m. For more information, camphillspecialschool.org.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
My first time ever?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
People just talking like normal people, telling me about the world.
There's always one story that makes me wake up.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again each weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about ADHD with Drs. Marilyn Wedge and Russell Ramsey. You touched, Russ, on emotional regulation, and that's something that seems to be increasing. What is it, and what are the best ways to deal with it for children first and then adults?
and writ large. But the point about the emotionality and oppositional behaviors, even though it's nowhere in the diagnostic criteria, we know that children and adolescents with ADHD are more likely to have emotional regulation difficulties. So part of it is the medications can be helpful. But in terms of psychosocial treatment, the therapy approaches, part of it is getting better versed in your risk factors, knowing what are the upsetting situations, what are the reactions that can be problematic. Being with teenagers and adults, they can be guided through monitoring their automatic thoughts and just noticing what their body is doing and behaviorally what may be moving them towards an undesirable response. Whereas with children, they might need some more support of parents and teachers helping guide them through different situations.
I've got a question about what has become the gold standard for so many, many things, and that's cognitive behavioral therapy. Does that work with kids? And it must look different.
It's very different. Thus far, for adults with ADHD, it's considered an evidence-supported treatment. It's just starting to be studied for adolescents with ADHD, but it's promising. For children, you're probably talking, they're going to need more support. It's going to be more the behavioral treatment, and very often what it takes the form of is training the parents and the teachers and working with the family. Sort of what was mentioned by the previous caller about, you know, how are rewards earned and delivered and just the structure of the household and really looking at things systemically there.
I want to pick up on that systemically business and turn to you, Marilyn, and I have a feeling you and I are going to be on the same page here. I am very uncomfortable sending young children to therapy and even diagnosing young children and, of course, medicating them, because that tells young children, adolescents, that there's something wrong with them and needs to be fixed. And, you know, that message can be as damaging as whatever they're in being treated for. Marilyn?
I totally agree with you, Dan. In fact, when I do family therapy for children who are sent to be evaluated, I see the child perhaps once with their family. Sometimes I don't even see the child. In fact, that's my preference. I work with the parents for 6 to 8 sessions, and usually that's enough. Usually it's coaching in discipline methods, or it's making sure that their child is getting enough sleep and not staying up texting all night? Or are they watching too much internet? I mean, there's research coming out now that too much internet time, video game time, can cause hyperactivity and inattentiveness in children and in adults.
It's that blue screen, and God knows there's a lot of that going around. I want to get to some concrete issues here, and we've got a caller, Jessica, on line one, who's, I think, going to help us get there. Jessica, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, I am a 28-year-old elementary school teacher who was diagnosed late in life, I guess, quote-unquote diagnosed, with ADHD, and I work with a lot of kids who are on medication. I work in a really urban area, and a lot of what you guys have been discussing has been about the home environment and all of these different resources for the family. But what I find is that I'm the person who's with these kids most of the time, and they don't have that support outside of school. The household is very disjointed. You know, they don't have someone to sit and do their homework with them. Often they're the ones who are helping their younger siblings make sure that they have something to eat for dinner. And it's all well and good to put these resources out there for the parents and to create this ideal home environment. But when it comes down to it, for, you know, the internet is, you know, the babysitter of this generation. And my curiosity is in this, you know, very real environment and this different kind of family dynamic where I guess I'm
What can we do for them? And of course, the easiest and cheapest intervention is pills. And these kids might not even have ADHD. You know, they could have emotional dysregulation, and it could be an acute or chronic stress reaction from an environment like that. And that's going to affect information processing in the brain. So, you know, I don't know if there is an answer. Russ, would you have one?
You know what? The caller brings up a great point, because one of the things we're just starting to tap into underserved populations, and you raise a great point that very often, at least with the adults that we see, one of the common things that will bring somebody in thinking they have ADHD, but then we hear there's some sort of traumatic event in their past, which is creating a quote-unquote attention deficit, but it's not ADHD. But going back to things that can be done, and, you know, credit to the teacher for, you know, helping out in that school district, but looking at, you know, what are the available resources, sometimes having to make do with less, and this is where getting involved, if there are after-school programs, and maybe the school district can't afford that, but if there are even neighborhood or some sort of formal sports activities. Now, we're not going to say that these are dye-in-the-wool treatments for ADHD, but it's ways to work the environment to try to come up and approximate what can be helpful for these, you know, underserved children.
Well, let's talk about something we know works and see if it can be modified for children. There's, and you both talk about this. There's a great deal of research on mindfulness meditation as a way of calming a dysregulated mind and getting us to be less reactive to stimulation. And, you know, I mean, the definition of meditation is cultivating attention to what's happening in the moment. So, I mean, that's one. And I also remember research I read, I wish I could cite the reference, years ago, about how kids, when they took a slow 15-minute walk in the park or in some kind of natural environment, that calmed their brain down as much as medication. So can this be modified for young children? Meditation. I know there's a lot of research and work out there.
Sure. I think, sure, Dan. In fact, in the book I talk about a young boy, a 10-year-old boy,
right,
who discovered meditation for himself. He discovered a YouTube tape of waves, and he would play them for himself when he got too hyper. So, sure, but I wanted to address Jessica, because I really think she's touched on something very important. The one thing I could suggest that's being used in Europe and very successfully is parenting classes. Sometimes even the school sponsors parenting classes to teach parents appropriate behavior. The other thing I would suggest...
I was just going to butt in real quick saying that that is something that our school offers, but there's only so much that you can provide when, you know, parents may not necessarily show up. And I don't mean to be such a negative Nancy, because that's not really...
Sure.
Jessica, what you're doing is being realistic. You're being painfully realistic. So, and listen, Marilyn and Russ, you know, I know the school district to which Jessica refers, and it is a desperately poor school district in New Jersey, one of the poorest in the country. So, you know, it's just not there for her. So, go on. I interrupted.
Yeah, I have one other thought that she might look into this program, a national program called Trauma Sensitive Schools, and it's being used widely in Washington with the recognition that a lot of these children with behavior problems or focusing problems are experiencing trauma in the home, and the school principals and teachers and staff are stepping up to the plate and doing what they can in the hours that they see the children to help calm them, soothe them, they might go to the principal's office for a few minutes and just sit covered with a blanket until they're ready to go back to the classroom. So I would just, if you haven't heard of it, trauma-sensitive schools, maybe take a look at it.
Marilyn, I think yes. That was just masterful, and I think that is such an important resource. And now I have to brag a little bit. All this got started with the work of Sandra Bloom and psychiatrist Sandra Bloom and Steve Berkowitz, and they're both here at University of Pennsylvania, and they're both experts in trauma and children's trauma. So, you know, look them up. Look up trauma-informed everything, trauma-informed therapy in schools. I think it's great, and it's not terribly expensive to bring this into to a school, and it's not terribly time-consuming. It's just a change of attitude. We don't have a lot of time, so just in a sentence or so, I'm going to ask you both your vision for the future. Russ?
Oh, well, I mean, part of it because it was just so salient right now, but I think, you know, reaching, now that we have some evidence-supported treatments, one of the things that's encouraging about ADHD, there's a lot that can be done from all facets, working with the environment, and it's sort of like the long reach. You know, we sort of know who we can help now, and sort of reaching those who, as the caller, as Jessica mentioned, may not have access to these services. How can we create some things and reach out to people who might be underserved by our existing treatments?
I've got to cut you off. Unfortunately, we've run completely out of time. And Marilyn, I apologize for your not having time to respond. I'd ask the callers, especially Jessica, please send me an email. We can talk about that. So I want to thank you both so much for joining us on today's show. We've covered a lot of territory here. There's lots more to discuss. Look at our webpage, and you'll see where it's going. I want to thank Drs. Marilyn Wedge and Russ Ramsey for joining us today. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our EP. Zakia Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces this show. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Here in